Take two. Welcome to the Interman Show. I'm your host, Dylan Eckes. I'm here with my co-host, Shane Cockrell. Shane, how are you doing tonight? How was ITTM?
I'm doing good. ITTM went great. We had everyone return that came the first week, so that's exciting. I wasn't sure what the reception would be, but had a couple of people reach out and say how awesome the program is, and they're looking forward to referring families and stuff, so that was really positive. And just doing it and learning more about it, because I'm still pretty new at it myself. I just did the training and still going through everything, and the more that I continue to grasp the stuff that comes along, the more that I'm, you know, the more that I believe in it, the more that I think it's the best thing that everyone should do. I really, truly believe that, and that it can benefit everyone at some degree.
Right. Rod, how do you feel?
I feel really good about it. Learning stuff that I wish I knew even 10 years ago.
Totally.
29.
Just heard that from one of the gentlemen tonight.
Great to know. Like, it would have saved a lot more hassle. I mean, it's intergenerational trauma.
Right.
So it's, yeah, what I'm learning now, yeah, if I learned it 10 years ago, it would have been totally different.
Like, I feel completely blessed that I was able to do this while I have young kids still.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Like, actually implement the stuff that I've learned and actually use it. It's like, okay, this is important stuff that I needed to learn about myself first. And then as a parent, who I am as a professional and all that kind of stuff. And everything is just kind of unfolded in a better way for me and how I deal with situations and how I conduct myself as a parent. So it's been fantastic so far.
Absolutely. Guys, we have a guest in studio today. We have Chief of Police, Mike Warden, in here with Medicine Hat Police Service. How you doing today, man?
I'm good. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for being here. We truly appreciate it. Why don't you kind of tell the listeners who you are, what you do, and how you got here?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a Medicine Hat native. Well, I think my family moved here, and I'm going to date myself here, back in the 72, so 3 years old, and my dad was the United Church Minister of Westminster United Church, so that's we moved here for that reason, and I grew up here till I was 18, and then off to Calgary to go to school, and then I worked for the Calgary Police Service for 25 years, and Chief Andy McGrogan retired right at the end of the year, so it was an opportunity to apply for the position, and it was a perfect fit for me.
Awesome.
My parents are still here. I have a sister still here, of course, and a niece and their family. So it all just fell together really well. So awesome. Yeah, excited to be back and, run into old friends and family and drive around a little bit. Some things have changed. Medicine Hat has expanded. They go into Southridge. We moved into Southridge years and years ago, and it's really changed, but, it's a great city.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again for doing this. What was it, what drove you to wanting to be a police officer? What was that like?
You know, it's funny, we get that question a lot, and I always thought about that, and it's when you're younger, you like that exciting part of the job.
So, totally.
Whether you see it on TV or you see it in person, and whether it's, car chases or the dynamic part of the job, that's an attraction as a young man. Mm-hmm. But, I thought more of it as I advance my career, and I equate it back to a little bit of what I went through as a youth with my family. We lived in the manse, which was right next door, still there, right next door to the Westminster United Church, and we'd always have homeless people would come to the back door, and my mom would make them a pot of soup and make a sandwich, and that was just the norm. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in this kind of environment of helping people, and I started to realize as I got further in my career, there was that part of me that was the draw to. So helping people who can't help themselves, it's helping victims and, ensuring there's some level of authority and justice in our society. So it was, that was a draw. I think so you grow up a little bit as you originally get into policing and you have one thought of why you're there, and then you make your way through it. And I can tell you early on, you are attracted to that part, but you start to realize that people, they struggle. Usually when I would, my first few years in policing, it was, you'd come across people with addictions or drinking, sleeping in the parks, and you just dealt with them. You'd either, if they were drunk, you'd take them to what they called the drunk tank, and that was it. You didn't give them much thought, but as I advanced and some of the philosophies in policing advanced and more towards that care part,
right.
then you start to realize, you start to wonder why they're there, what brought them there, what is their, what backgrounds, and can you help them? Is putting them in jail for the night, is that the answer? And you start to look for other, you know, resources. So you can see how it's all, society's advanced in that, mm-hmm. in that spectrum. That's where we are now. I know we're struggling with that too here, mm-hmm. even in Medicine Hat, trying to find the resources, the best resources for people. And sometimes you can't, you can do your best to take people to those resources, but they're like, you know, take a horse to water, right? You can't force it to drink, kind of thing. But
that's right. It's not ready.
Yeah. So it's ensuring that they're there when they are, the resources. And I think that's kind of some of the work that you're doing is, mm-hmm. is working with people, and they may not be ready to have those conversations, but being there when they are, being mm-hmm. ready when they are ready. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're just providing another bucket of water, right? That's all it is, right? So, so being in, you know, community service and public service, that was kind of what you saw growing up. And now, you know, with the, your role as chief of police, what was it like transitioning? Were you in a position like you were in Calgary, or is this a new position for you?
Yeah. So I was, in Calgary, there's, close to 2,200 police officers. So I was a superintendent. So, in charge of several different areas while I was there, but, I spent a lot of time in our HR areas. Mm-hmm. So I was, at one point I was the inspector of the sworn part of the HR. So 2,200 police officers. So it was my responsibility to manage all those programs. And then I was, assigned the chief human resource officer spot for 2 years just before I left. And that was the entire service of 3,000 people. So I saw, a variety of things. And a lot of the things that I saw were the officers that went through struggles and our civilian employees as well. And, there's officer misconduct issues. And I just saw, the difficulties that people have. And sometimes I think people think police officers are robots and they don't have feelings. And, mm-hmm. They can just sit there and have people scream and yell at them and it doesn't mm-hmm. affect them. And
right.
but it does. And that was some of the things that we tried to do is build programs. Again, kind of like some of the work that you're doing mm-hmm. to ensure that there's something there to support them through it. And it's a, you talk about the stigma. I saw a change. I talked about it during Mental Health Week a couple years ago. But I saw the change from an organization who used to have a psychologist. And I think I've heard the name before in other organizations, but the nickname was Dr. Bonkers. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to see Dr. Bonkers, that was, you were weak, you were troubled, you weren't going to get promoted, all these different things. So no one trusted the system. But it advanced over the 20 years to a point where people would be very open about going. Mm-hmm. And it was a part of, if you were going into a new unit, you'd have to go see the psychologist and mm-hmm. have a check-in, a wellness check-in. And I myself did it because I knew that it was important for kind of model that. So yeah, I would go and
be a role model, right?
Yeah, and talk to them, and I continue to do it. So I continue to talk with the person I was dealing with mm-hmm. just because I found it helpful. Mm-hmm. Like it's just to sit down and talk to somebody about, what's, I do it once a month and just sit down and talk about every month and the things that I've struggled with. I've always found it helpful. And I think just having that conversation with somebody you can trust, mm-hmm. Again, there's when you get into policing, into the core of it, sometimes there's not a lot of trust in that because, again, people are fearful that it's going to affect them in their careers, and people are going to think that they're weak. Mm-hmm. It's that stigma that we continue to battle with.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, I know, I guess being in the law enforcement side of things, too, it's not as easy, even for myself, in with the general population when we have our drop-ins. I can't necessarily speak about the stuff that I go through or what I deal with and what bothers me, except when we go up to Calgary, because we have several gentlemen that are actually in that field. So it's mostly actually law enforcement. So I feel at home and I can actually open up and speak my mind, and that's a really nice feeling. So that's kind of what it's really important that you guys have a program like that in the police service. So you guys are talking to your own peers, because technically we can't really talk about the stuff outside of our own job mm-hmm. or don't feel comfortable to, because no one really understands or really gets it. Right.
Yeah, definitely. That trust factor is so huge. And you're right. There is, you can tell when people are willing to share experiences, and they'll know when they talk about something that might be bothering them. Mm-hmm. They know the person across the table or a person that they're, that's in the room may have experienced themselves, or they have an understanding. And policing isn't rocket science, but there are some things. It's like any industry, there's a comfort around people that have a familiarity to it. So
to understand the dynamics and have the certain emotions that come with the job. And like you said, people think that police officers are robots. in reality, we're all human beings. Yeah. We all experience anger and frustration. We all experience sadness. We all experience depression or lows in our life. And would you still see it being a struggle with that stigma with today's, you know, generation of police officers?
It's less for sure. And I think it's because our society, that the officers now that are being hired, mm-hmm. have grown up in the more accepting, mm-hmm. environment. So there's less of a stigma. It still is there.
Right.
Like it still is there. And it'll take a long time. I don't know if we'll ever get rid of it, but, it still continues. But, I think for us, again, I'll continue to push. That was one of the things when I came here, is one of my mandates was to look at the programs here, and they have a great program, and just see if we can do things better,
right.
Because they're even make it even better than what it is now. So
there's always room for improvement, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And
taking more steps. Baby steps before you can walk, more or less.
Yep. Yeah.
If you can mandate going, let's say, just once a month, that one cop who's been having a shit month and it's showing in his job, going to that once a month, finding that one person to talk to could have a complete 180 turn on how he performs his job, which takes away also from the public stigma that, well, cops are robots. They're only out to arrest people that aren't really doing anything. Like, I know in Medicine Hat, the big one, if you ever look on Medicine Hat confessions or the bitching page that they have, it's fucking cops pulled me over for tint. Fuck, don't they know anything? I'm paying their bills. Or like I'm paying their salary and stuff. Right. I'm like, well, yeah, like it's a safety thing. I was young and stupid. I had tint before I got pulled over for it. Yeah. Lots. And I'm like, fine. Like, it's pretty simple, other than like $150 every 2 weeks.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's simple. It's illegal. It's for your safety.
Yeah.
That's why we do it. That's why it's done.
Well, one of the things with, you know, whether it's therapy or mental health professionals or even our drop-in groups, one of the things that we talk about is like, okay, so if you're not taking care of yourself and your mental health or your physical health, let's say, how are you supposed to be taking care of your family? Or 100%. your colleagues, or, you know, when you have teams or, you know, tactical teams or things like that, how are you supposed to be the best version of yourself if you're not taking care of yourself, right? So to be that role model for, you know, your colleagues and your teammates, I think that's huge. And it starts from the top down, right? If you can have a leader or somebody who's in your position saying, hey, this is what I'm doing. I'm taking that initiative. I'm taking these steps to better myself once, twice, three times a month. And it's turning my life around personally and professionally. Then, like Rod said, then the stigma with the public's going to change, right? They're human beings, right? Oh, yeah. You know, they have emotions too. Oh, they're getting help too. Okay, I see where it's going, right? So what seems to, I know you've only been in Medicine Hat for 9 months. In your experience, we've obviously had some stressful times the last, you know, 2 to 3 years. Has there been an increase of burnout or depression or stress among, your colleagues with the service?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. There has been, over the last few years, heavy scrutiny on policing. You've seen everything from early on, from the Ferguson events to the, you know, all the things that have occurred in the U.S. and they impact us here.
Of course, it's just that trickle-down effect. Yeah. Everything that happens there happens to us six, 7 months
George
later.
Floyd, those are horrific things to occur. And so that scrutiny that shines a light on us, and we get painted with some of those same rushes, and that weighs heavy on people. It does. Like,
totally.
You pretend that it doesn't, and, you know, you come to work and try not to, try to ignore it, but it does weigh heavy on them. So, and when you talk about the COVID environment and, you know, the divide in the community, again, so our officers are attending some of these calls where there's this, you know, back and forth between people, and they're being the mediators between that too. So it's been a struggle, and the officers, I thought, have done a really nice job, have supported each other.
Yeah.
So has it increased? I would say yes. I just don't know what level. Mm-hmm. You know, I do, obviously we have a psychological services program, and it's, the nice thing about it is it's all confidential. So I don't know who's going. I don't know. Sometimes that's good. And of course I would never ask for that, but it's kind of nice to, you know, nice to know, hey, are things getting, like, are officers seeing more of the program or less, and that type of thing. But also, if you support it more and our officers are going to see it more, then that may be a false positive, right? To say that, okay, more people are going. It's like, is that good or bad? Like, mm-hmm. In a way, I think that's good.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah. So it's I guess you have to be careful with the data and how you interpret it.
Right? Yeah. It would be nice to have like some sort of like data or, you know, statistics saying like, well, over the course of, you know, say the George Floyd, when that whole issue went through and, you know, the big divide between community and police happened, it would be nice to know if that increased during that time and then slowed down after the kind of the dust had settled a little bit. Obviously, it's still a pretty pertinent, you know, racism is massive in the States. And of course, it's here too. It trickles down. But like, it would be nice to have that data is like when those really significant things hit, is that when things getting utilized or is it going to be constantly utilized just throughout their careers?
Yeah.
That'd be a nice statistic to know.
You know, what we do use is we use the public input is typically, and I, you know, I'm careful to say too much about social media because it's a double-edged sword for
sure. Oh yeah.
It's so valuable to share information and share ideas and get feedback, but it's also seems to be an avenue now where people can just openly, like you said, just openly complain about things and without any, I'm not going to say consequence, but you know, something, I can say something about you that I wouldn't say to your face, but I can say it totally here. So there's heavy criticism there, but, I think the nice thing is we find here is in Medicine Hat anyway, our officers will be out for coffee and people just come by and they thank them, you know, thank you for what you do. And that is what it's weight in gold.
The police service here has always felt like small town.
Yeah.
Like obviously, you know, I was a dickhead 16-year-old at one point in time speeding around town, but anytime I've ever been pulled over as an adult, it's been for silly things, but they've always been respectful. I know one incident last summer, it was actually right after the George Floyd incident. My wife got pulled over and the police officer, for lack of a better word, was stoic. Like he just no emotions, wasn't angry, wasn't upset. And she was frustrated because the kids are crying in the back seat. She's pulled over on the side of 13th Ave. And she's just like, he didn't seem like he wanted to budge. I'm like, could you imagine the scrutiny that he has to deal with every single day? Mm. You got pulled over at 6 p.m. Like he's at the end of his day.
Yeah.
Like,
changes right away.
Yeah. So like, I totally get where that sentiment comes from because, you know, here in Medicine Hat, like I said, and like you just said, I think it's more that small town feel. And, you know, I think in bigger communities, and you can speak on this, you kind of lose that feel of, you know, to serve and protect. You're still, you know, in the community, you're a public servant, you're supposed to be boots on the ground. And I think a lot of, you know, our, especially the generation today with the youth, they kind of don't understand that you can go up to a police officer and have a conversation with them because that's their job,
right? And a normal conversation. It doesn't even have to be like I could see you on the street, Mike, and be like, hey, did you see the hockey game last night? Totally.
We always talk to the young families. They'll say, oh, you know, they'll grab their young children and say, you know, don't be bad or this police officer is going to come and do, and we don't say that to them. Like, scare them because we don't want to be locked in the closet and only brought out when bad things happen.
Yeah. That's right.
But you want to be like this guy.
Yeah.
And that was a thing with me growing up too. Like I'm pretty sure we were all from the same generation where you'd be bad, the cops will get you and you're like, oh, damn. And then, I mean, that gets put into your head as a young kid. So I'm like, when I was 16, 17 years old, like I still respected the cops, but as soon as their backs were turned, I'm like, fucking pig, fucking exactly. Right. Calling you every single name in the book. And then they'll turn around and I'll be like, officer, how are you doing? I mean, it goes back to like, what you're talking about, the guy talking on Facebook, they're just keyboard gangsters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. They'll say whatever they want. Cause there's no worry about it. And then you see them in public and you're like, oh, did you say this about me? No, that wasn't me.
And I had a completely different perception growing up because I have family members in law enforcement. And when I had a cousin, and he's a staff sergeant out in Brooks now, and he was saying, like, I just knowing him and knowing who he is as a person, I'm like, I can't believe you're a police officer.
Yeah.
Because you're a different person as a civilian. Mm-hmm. But you're also not.
Yeah,
totally. At the same time, you're still the same guy, just you have a uniform on.
Yeah.
So like, and knowing who he is as a person, that he's, you know, kind-hearted, that he's, you know, giving, that he's, you know, firm but fair. And it's like, okay, I have a perception of who you are and that's who you are as a police officer too. So it's, I had a positive interaction my entire life and it was always good for me that way.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the big things when I was growing up, from a small town, like 2,000, 2,500 people with surrounding area, my grandma used to live in this little cul-de-sac and we'd play street hockey every day. Like, so no, there's no traffic. It was full blown. Mm. We can play for hours and I'm not a big worry, but there was a cop that lived right across from like, or in this cul-de-sac. And he was a constable. I want to say his name is Jason Penner. And he was awesome. Like, he played volleyball for the UFC, I think he said. Anyways, he was friends with my dad, helped him out with volleyball when he was coaching, and he'd come play hockey with us. So like, he became really close friends with like all the kids in that little area at like 12, 13. And then when he got transferred, cause it was the RCMP. So he got transferred, I think it's like after 4 years or something like that, they got transferred to another place.
It used to be that way. It's not, it still is kind of, but not so much.
Yeah. And, when he left, we were 16, me and my best friend. So we drove up to Grand Prairie, which is like 2 hours from home. And we picked up a dozen donuts, right? Because we were that close, we can bug them about this type of stuff. And inside the, we ate all the donuts anyways, but inside, inside the donut box, we had a package of bacon because we could joke around with him, because he was in, like you said, being a civilian, totally different. And then like, I know you as a civilian and I can't believe you're also a cop too. It's two different, like, right. And, when he opened it up, he opened it up and right on the, as soon as you open up the, donut box, it said bad cop, no donuts. Right. And he like started laughing instantly. And I mean, I wish I was still able to keep in contact with him, because it's one of the, like, it's, there's good people and bad people. It doesn't matter what profession you're in.
Totally.
But I've noticed more with cops, one bad apple screws the whole thing, like the George Floyd thing.
Yeah.
Bad apple, and everyone's like, all cops are racist.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. No, that's not how it works, you guys. No.
Well, it's just so easy to paint a brush with everyone in that regard. And, you know, most people, I'd like to think, when they do join police, that they have the right intentions.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the stuff that people are exposed to over time, it's hard not to get jaded. I would be lying if I said I'm not a little bit, you know what I mean? And you develop a dark humor, you develop like a kind of like an emotional wall. And, you know, probably like that officer that pulled over your wife was probably just, you know, that was just his job. That's what he does. And, you know, this is how I conduct every single thing. It's nothing against you. It's just how I do it.
Yeah.
So like it's especially, it's obviously easier for someone like myself to kind of relate. Cause I mean, obviously you guys are more general population, but at the end of the day, they are just collectively, they want to help the community. That's why they get into these kind of jobs. Right.
Yeah. Well, I grew up with my uncle in law enforcement, my mom's twin brother. And, and then the opposite side of my family, there's a lot of, you know, criminal activity, drug use, that sort of thing. Talked about it, and Pierre talked about it on the podcast. So I saw both sides of the spectrum. You know, I saw people in my own family who were, you know, involved with criminal activity, being arrested, watching them get arrested. And then I saw my other side of the family where my uncle's in law enforcement. You know, he's dealing with, you know, and he worked in customs for a long time too. You know, whether it was, you know, being held literal hostage at the border, guns and knives pulled on him. And he would have these open conversations with a 13, 14 year old version of Dylan. And so I got to see both sides of that conversation. And I was lucky enough to were a couple of the guys from the station. I have to say station. I can't say the force words. So, a couple of the guys from the service, I was able to be friends with them when I was about 19, 20, and, you know, hearing their perspective, you know, when we're working out in the gym or whatever. It's just fascinating to me that I think there needs to be some sort of like training for the average kid that comes out of high school on how to be respectful to, you know, just service members, whether that's politics or police officers or first responders, some sort of training for young people. Because, you know, from my experience and Shane, maybe you can touch on this a little bit, depending on what you can dive into, of course, but it seems to be like today's youth have almost zero respect for that authority. And that, like, when we were growing up, police officers come into our school, it'd be like, oh, that's a police officer. Mm-hmm. And now it's, you know, I hear stories from my wife, she's a counselor at school, and these kids just don't care. Is that a disconnect with today's generation? Is it social media? What is that?
I mean, for me, what I can say is when I have a risk assessment, with a kid, the question's always brought up, like, do you respect authority figures, law enforcement, whatever it might be? And it's a good portion of it's always no. Mm-hmm. And I always ask, well, how come? And the answer is always, I don't know. I just don't.
Yeah, they just don't. Yeah.
And I'm like, but you understand that I'm law enforcement. They're like, yep. And I was like, what did I do to you for you to have that disrespect for me? Mm-hmm. Not like questioning them or being a jerk or anything, but just kind of getting them to understand the broader picture here is like, I'm giving you respect right now and I'm treating you. I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to do everything to make you successful on this. Why don't you like someone like me who's trying to help you out? Mm-hmm. And then they're like, well, I guess that's true.
And you're like that.
And then you're like, well, what do you think police do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think your parents do? What do you think teachers do? These are all authority figures in your life. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, they all want you to succeed and grow as a person. Mm-hmm. But you don't like them because of, you know, whatever it might be, social media, even parents or, you know, someone telling them like, oh, police are bad or that's what they're growing up with, but they just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And even with, you know, law enforcement and teachers, right? I see that you know, sometimes there's a lack of respect there. And I know growing up again, there was a healthy respect for law enforcement and teachers. I mean, they're, what a tough job they have, and you know, more NYC criticism to what they're doing, and you know, I think they're probably experiencing the same thing, but I think it's a focus on, and probably the original question, I think it could be a focus on those one or two events, and I'm the first to say we're going to make mistakes, mm-hmm. like we're going to make mistakes.
Human beings, right?
Yeah. So I say to my crew, like, what we're going to do, make mistakes, we're going to stand up, we're going to apologize, and we're going to promise to get better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What else can you do, right? What else can
you do? Always take ownership, right?
There's a saying, it's when you fess up, you dress up, and you, how does it go again? When you mess up, you dress up and you fess up. Mm-hmm. So get up there and apologize and just say, we're going to do better. So what more can you ask for? But because they are humans and they're going to make mistakes. But, you know, there's different levels of mistakes, really. Again, I'll talk about that with my group is, you know, someone to make a mistake during arrest or make a decision, real quick decision that you had to make. And if you're doing it with good intentions, then that can be somewhat different. But if you're doing it with malice or you're doing it with, you know, on purpose to hurt somebody, then that's different.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's those one or two events that have skewed the thoughts of police officers in our society. But, you know, one thing I do say here in Medicine, we have great support, and that comes from years and years of respectful policing of our communities. Mm-hmm. So when I came here, I was just like, this is great. The community supports. Mm-hmm. There are the odd, obviously you're going to have people, I get it, when you're either being stopped for speeding or something you're doing wrong, you're not going to be in a happy place.
Mm. Yeah.
But if there's just an understanding, like we talked about earlier, just, you know, doing their jobs and enforcing laws that we have here to keep this a safe place to live. And you know, on one end you'll have people screaming and yelling about the speeding, and other ends you'll have people saying that the speed limits are too slow here. So you've got,
you're trying to appease everyone.
That's our massive city debate. But I think you're absolutely right. When I think of, like, I explain to my kids, I'll get a photo radar ticket. That's my jam. It's the same light in Calgary every time I enter the city too. Never changes. But I explain to them, like, they ask what it is and they make fun of me. I owe them money. They say, I owe them money. I'm like, yeah, but that's me not learning my lesson. Right. And so I, the way I see it is just like, police officers are literally here to serve and protect us. When we get tickets for tint or speeding, it's because we're putting other people in jeopardy and they're saying, Hey, don't do that. And this is what you're going to pay now as, you know, a fine or a ticket. So you don't do that again. It's a reminder. Right. And when you start looking at it through that lens, you realize, like you said, everyone who is in a hurry is usually frustrated in traffic.
Yeah,
you know, so that when you pull them over, they're going to be even more frustrated, right? So, I think it comes hand in hand. The thing I noticed with the youth, though, is, you know, you and I were kind of talking about this earlier today, but like when we were growing up, it was the music. Like MTV or Much Music or whatever we were listening to. And today,
someone to place the blame on.
Yeah. It was just like, or like the music we grew up with, like gangster rap and that sort of thing. It was just like, it was very much against police officers. And then when you have incidents like what happened last year in 2020 with the riots and everything and the George Floyd incident, you have this little computer at your fingertips and it's shared millions and millions and millions of times, and kids have access to this as young as 9 years old. So now we're talking about a whole swath of kids, even younger today,
have access to that information and that skewed perception.
Just conditioning them to think a certain way, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And social media is a big component of that. And obviously, like, I know the, you know, Metro Police Service and most police services utilize social media, mm-hmm. you know, to gather information for asking for public assistance and stuff like that, which is all positive, great stuff. Yeah. But it also can be used in such a horrible capacity, like we spoke off air about. It can be the best thing or the worst thing. And, you know, like you said, young people have a lot of access to that kind of stuff, and typically see more negative than positive these days.
Right. Yeah. When you talk about social media and you talk about the mental health of our youth, or you talk connected to crime, I'm sure you see this all the time. And you know, the studies show, I think anywhere to 50 to 70% of youth that are in the justice system or criminal records have some sort of mental health issue.
Right.
So it's in connected. I don't think social media helps that. I think mm-hmm. there's, you know, I think as a younger kid, when I grew up, and you know, we all had our struggles through mm-hmm. through life, you know, growing up, through peer pressure and all those different things, and your hormones driving as you're getting older. But I think now with social media and the pressures that come through there, and that this, you know, these whatever they are, these apps that they use on their phones, and they're always trying to make themselves look better, and that this pressure to be something that they're not. It's
so magnified with the likes, and every time they open their phone, they're looking for another comment or another share or
instant gratification.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's
a dopamine rush, right?
Yep,
every time. Right.
So what does that do to their mental health? And then you wonder why some of these youth are getting themselves into trouble. They're screaming for help, or they're struggling with whatever that might bring. So, and I'm sure you see it all the time. You probably see the struggles of the youth and mental health and in the system, and definitely, I mean, all the research connects it for sure. So it's a matter of, I think, when you look at that, how do we fix that, right? I think we need to make sure we have programs like yours, mm-hmm. right? We get the early intervention part of this. We get to kids early. We get them talking about their issues. As a young kid, my dad was a minister, and then he went to be a family service. He was with Medicine at Family Service and then a grief counselor. So I was lucky enough to have someone in the house that would be able to talk about different things. But I know there are sometimes others that don't have someone to talk to, right? They don't know whether it's at school or wherever it might be with their friends. And I remember as a kid, you know, going through a pretty horrific incident when I was in high school. Two of my high school friends were in an accident, and a couple of them were killed. And you really didn't know how to deal with it, right? There wasn't anyone there. And my dad was there, luckily, would kind of talk to me a little bit. But it plays a part.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You deal more of it as an adult than you did during the time, right?
Yeah.
Because it's that unresolved trauma. That's what we talk about in ICTM all the time. So what I find most with youth, especially with social media and stuff like that, is they build a perception of who they are on social media, and then they have to back that up in real life because they don't know how to, you know, they don't have the thought processes. The frontal cortex is not completely developed at that point. They don't know how to make the decisions, but they're like, this is what I look like here. So this is what I have to look like out here. So they are doing the major, like, horrible things, like selling drugs, like a 12-year-old selling drugs. And like, that's normalized a lot of the times now in this city.
Well, with Snapchat and things like that, right?
You get the disappearing, you know, texts and everything like that. And there's just, your guys' hands are tied a lot of the times too. And it's, and mine are too. And that's just how it is. Mm-hmm. But they'll sit there and tell me everything. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, see you later. And there's no consequence.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
And so what you're seeing then is, like, it's the opposite of being your authentic self. You know, as a business owner, you want to be your authentic self online, so you create more clientele. And these kids are creating this persona that's not even them. So then they're trying to, in the real life, they're trying to keep up with this fake authenticity, mm-hmm. right?
I have these kids in front of me that, like, are perceived badasses. Like, as you know, the city is pretty small, and the circles are pretty close to who hangs out with who. So a lot of the people that I deal with all hang out with each other. So names are dropped all the time, and who's doing what and X, Y, Z. But you get them in front of you and you see them as a kid. You see them who they are as a person, as a kid,
right.
And they're not the person that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And you try to get them to realize that, but, you know, it's like, there is going to be someone bigger. Mm-hmm. There is someone going to be badder, and you're not who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to be a worse consequence than anything I can give.
And that's really them. That's who they are.
And right. then you get the tears, and then you get the, you know, the real authentic young person in front of you.
Right.
But as soon as they leave that door, they're on their phones and they're like, ah, I'm still this.
It's yeah, it's, you know, so I think what you're doing, and again, I talk, you refer to your programs, you know, the preventative work is so important, right? And to be able to have a safe place where people can share those conversations. I'm sure those conversations you have with those kids are helpful.
Absolutely.
Right. Yes. So while they may shut down again, I can tell you police officers are awesome for going to a traumatic event, whether it be an accident or a suicide or a murder, whatever. And they'll just put that aside and go on to the next one. And you only got so much room up there. Right. So when it starts to overflow. So I do believe, I'm a big believer in that early intervention with kids and teaching them those skills to how to deal with things as they get older, that resiliency as they get older. So I think the work that we're doing in that stream is great. Yep. And then the work that we're doing to destigmatize having conversations is, you know, we talk about men, right? There's it's to sit around and have that conversation around how you doing, you doing okay. And you almost have to blend it in just with the, I was a football game last night. And then how you doing, right? Like, you know, you almost have to just mesh it in. I had a conversation with a fellow by the name of Bob Wilkie. He's got a, I got mind programmed. So I used to play NHL in the NHL and, we're talking about his program.
He has a non-for-profit in Calgary.
Yeah.
Yes. I know Bob.
And we're talking, he goes, Mike, how you doing? I said, yeah, I'm doing okay. You know, I've been doing this. He goes, no, Mike, how you doing?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, this is uncomfortable. He's forcing me. I'm like, Bob, come on. Like, so we got into a good conversation about, you know, some of the things that keep me up at night and, you get in your head. Like I'm sure we all do. We get something in our heads and we play around with it. And you don't really, until you actually say those words or talk to somebody about it, like just then they kind of help you contextualize what actually is you might be feeling, or maybe, you're, you know, they'll give you another way to look at it and things like that.
Yep.
Then it's almost like you're sitting home alone in a dark room and you just start, it just starts to build and build and build. And
I really want to transition and talk about mental health and medicine hat and what your perception has been. I moved here in 2018. How long have you guys, have been here for 10 plus years at this point? You've been here your whole life.
I've lived here since.
I've been here 3 years.
Okay. So I moved here in 2018 from Calgary. Kind of a totally different scenario. I live downtown Calgary. So I've seen, you know, homelessness, addiction. It's almost like it's just part of big city living because there's so many people. When I moved to Medicine Hat, one of the things they prided themselves on was, you know, no homeless people.
Yeah.
You know, people, you have a place to go.
Quote unquote.
Quote unquote. Yeah. And the last 3 years I've like, we used to live in the flats and we've moved up to another area. But even in the last 3 years, I've seen a steady increase of homelessness, addictions, to the point where I go through my old neighborhood and three of the houses that were beside me are now boarded up, you know, and like, so people are losing their properties. People are losing their homes. You're seeing these numbers increase. Has that been something that, you know, is a concern with you guys in the service?
That is. So one of the things when people ask me, you know, they'll say, how's, you know, what's it like in Medicine Hat? What are some of the issues here? And, you know, I say drugs and mental health. Those are the two main issues. We have some property crime issues, but most cities do. But the mental health issues are of concern. I know there's a number of organizations in the city all working towards this. And working, like, you know, to home people. And there's some people who just, they don't want it, right? Again, we talked about that. You can present that option to them and they just don't want it. But it definitely, it's one of the reasons we have a downtown patrol unit, is they are there daily and dealing with these people and trying to, you know, whether it's convince them to go to some sort of resource or whatever, but it definitely is when you talk about mental health connected to homelessness, connected to addiction, right? They're all just hand in hand. So it's building those wraparound services and ensuring, you know, like ensuring that we're all working towards one goal. And it's a great group here. One thing I did when I first came, I was just amazed at the number of organizations that are trying to tackle this issue. And every city's dealing with it. I was on a call today with a group of people and from, you know, Lethbridge, Edmonton, Calgary, all the cities are trying to figure this out.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes police officers, they'll go to these calls, whether it be, you know, someone that's homeless or even, you know, it reaches all boundaries here. It's everywhere in Medicine Hat and they do their best to address the issue and try to get some resources in place. But you know what, at some point they have to go to the next call. So hopefully those people will reach out for resources and things like that. But, you know, there's a lot of times we're back there a week later dealing with it again. But, I know that the downtown issue is of concern.
Right.
And it's something that is, it's something we talk about weekly.
Yeah, I think that was a big step, having that downtown unit.
Yeah, there. Walking the beat down in that area was, it's done a lot of positive things, mm-hmm. for sure, compared to what it used to be. I remember even before, like just before you guys implemented that, just driving down there, I was like, that's my client, that's my client, mm-hmm. that's my client, yeah. that's my client. And I'm just like, they all go in the same place. They all are, you know, struggling mentally. They're all struggling with addictions, and they're all, this is their meeting point. Mm-hmm. And obviously, like, it's just going to get moved to a different spot. But if we can slowly decrease the areas and make it a little less prominent and slow it down and try to get these people to the resources that they need,
right.
then that's, you know, a win. Even if we get one or two out of a group, like that's a start.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's little wins like that. And, you know, again, you talk about the research with youth anyway. And, you know, I think they, whatever the percentages are, there's greater, far greater success with rehabilitation programs than there is incarceration.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, we could probably go down and arrest the group of people that are downtown, find something to arrest them, mm-hmm. do our best to get them in jail. But are we solving the problem now? We're making it worse. Mm-hmm. They're going to be back out again. The recidivism is going to continue.
Right.
So we need to find ways to, you know, there's got to be consequence for certain things.
Yes.
So I'm not saying that we're, you know, we have a, you know, unfettered downtown where people can do drugs wherever they want and do whatever they want. You can't have that, but
right.
you also can't lock them up for everything. So it's mm-hmm. finding those resources. And again, you just have to continue. You just have to be tenacious in presenting resources to these people. And hopefully at some point you're going to make that connection.
So do you have go-to resources that Medicine Hat uses in Medicine Hat, like, do you use Canadian Mental Health? Is there like McMahon? Is there certain?
You want either one?
Yeah,
all of them. So we're connected with all of them. Again, that was one of the things I was so impressed with when I came here was the connections we have, and they're always reaching out for. We're probably reaching out to them more than they reach out to us, because mm-hmm. we're always looking for ideas, and they're running programs all the time, and we do our best to try to jump in when we can. But mm-hmm. it's such a great care down there with that group. They're all kind of situated pretty closely together downtown, but. There definitely is, there's a desire. Like, it's not for lack of trying, lack of desire. It's, I don't think there's any magic pill for this one.
No.
Bad analogy.
There really isn't. And Shane and I, we've went through the struggle here the last year. One of the things that I think every organization struggles with is the funding for everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, the funding for, you know, whether it's programs, staff, psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, therapists, you name it, there needs to be government funding from it. And then all of a sudden, when we're in the middle of a pandemic and we're already, you know, the debt limit's already as high as it can be, it's just like, okay, I get that we're low on funding, but like, our cities are collapsing from within, and you have police services, and you have nonprofit organizations, and you have family services all trying to work together to sort this problem out. And it just feels like it's growing and growing. So taking the funding out of it, like, from my perception, you know, when I saw the downtown unit come in, I'm heavy downtown. I'm there all the time with clients or banks and whatever else. And I thought to myself, this is a great thing that happened. And the reason was, is because I think it was like just before the downtown unit was introduced, or maybe it was just after, there was a picture of a gentleman defecating on the side of the street in Medicine Hat that went viral on Facebook, and people were yelling at him and screaming at him on the comments and making fun of him and sharing it. And I just thought to myself, this is why we need the downtown unit, so these people can at least be pointed in the direction of where that water is, right? Like you said, you can't make them drink it, but at least you can show them where it is. And Shane and I run into this all the time. Rod's probably dealt with it now that he's in our support chat and dealing with the nonprofit, is we realize when people are in that mental health crisis, they don't think to pick up their phone and Google mental health resources in Medicine Hat. There's not one thought process of that. And then you add in the fact that there's might be substance misuse, and then you add in the fact that there's legitimate mental illness. These people may not even have a phone, right? So, you know, I think that the downtown unit's a great step in the direction of helping solve our problems.
You make such a great point there. People always say, why don't they just stop doing drugs? Mm. Like, they're addicted. Why don't they just stop? Like, just, but you.
So much. If it was only that easy, right?
It was only that easy, right? It's, yeah. it's, it, and I've dealt with, you know, we had a young man coming into our lives 5 or 6 years ago. He lived with us for 3 years, and we had it was a difficult time, and it was really, really eye opening for me to see like you always just kind of, why wouldn't he do this? And you're like, because he's going through struggles. Like you talked about in crisis, people in crisis, it's difficult for them to make choices. I did. So I always talk about this. I took some negotiator training, of course. It was dealing with people in crisis. And the analogy they use to me is people that are in crisis, they use this television analogy. They have seven or eight televisions going at the same time. And your role is to try to shut down one after the other so that all they're doing is now they're watching one television. You've got their attention, right? Because when you're trying to talk to somebody, they're watching all these televisions. That's what their mind's doing.
Yeah.
Is watching all these TV. You can't focus. There's no focus. You're trying to get them to say, hey, okay, you know, do this. Whether it's come off the bridge or come out of your house or whatever. They can't fathom that because they've got so much going on. So it's okay, what's your issue? Okay, this is one issue. Okay, we're going to take care of that. Okay, you know, turn your lights. A lot of times if we were, you know, in and around a house, we'd be like, well, you got bright lights on there. Okay, shut those lights off. Okay, we'll shut them off. Okay, boom, there's one. And you slowly make your way trying to get them to focus. So it's...
Yeah.
You slow things down.
Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. Completely mitigate any stress that's going on.
Get to the core, right? Yeah. Get to the hooks and triggers, we'd call them. It'd be something you can talk to someone about that's a hook. It's like, that's what they really care about. A trigger is something that they hate.
Yeah.
So you always have to figure out what those would be. So
yeah, and we've dealt with hundreds of men at this point online. One of the things that we notice is like everything, when somebody comes to us with a mental health crisis, it's just so much in their life is going on. You know, their dog's passed away. They're fighting with their wife. They're broke. They're unemployed. You know, so many things that are circumstantial are going on all at once, and they just can't seem to slow anything down. And, you know, and like you said, I think the biggest factor is when it comes to specifically men, because this is a men's podcast, is men have to be willing to slow things down themselves and say, I need help. Mm-hmm. And go out and get that help. And, you know, when you talk about people with addiction or mental illness, it's easier said than done, right?
Yeah. I mean, I totally respect the work that you're doing, because how do you make it safe first for a man to say, I need help? Like, how do you get that person to raise their hand? And is there going to be criticism, right? Is there that stigma that they're weak and they're not as, you know, they're not... respected by other people because of it. So how do we get there?
And what we've truly learned is it's like men are yearning to talk about their problems. And they need that outlet. They need something to, like, it is not hard to get a conversation going when we have men in a room at all. Like, you know, we, you know, bull crap about some, you know, the hockey game or whatever it might be. And then 2 minutes later, we're talking about someone's deepest, darkest secrets.
Right. Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, that was a transition, but here we are, right? And but like it is this is something that like men are screaming for, something like this, just to get out. And it's less invasive, at least from what we've heard. Our feedback is less invasive than going to counseling. It's and not that we're downplaying counseling at all, because it's very important for a lot of people, but at the end of the day, it's easier for them to walk in the door because it's just another guy like me. You know, we're not therapists. We don't know what we're doing other than just open-ended questions and providing a safe place for people to, you know, talk about their stuff without being judged.
Well, and how many times have we gone around in a circle, introduced everybody, right? Everybody says, I'm John, I'm this, I'm that. And then all of a sudden you tell a little bit, we do a thing called good, bad, and the ugly. Something's going good in your life, bad in your life, and something you really need to talk about. And, you know, after 5 or 6 times, most guys don't have a lot of negative stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
But when we go around in a circle and there's a new guy and we all start talking about our issues, like instant tears, guys breaking down, asking for help, telling their story, it's powerful because like these gentlemen have said tonight, it's all about your peers, right? Mm. So, you know, and that ties into, you know, the stigma that you see on the force as well, right? Sorry, the service.
Yeah, we've come a long way though.
Yeah,
it's an all policing now. There's a respect for the services that our psychological teams provide, and we just need to do it more. I wish I had a greater budget to put towards this. Do our best to funnel as much money as we can, but obviously we're, you know, like everyone's limited budget. So but it's you know our the hard part for us is. It typically action isn't taken. If someone's not doing it proactively, action isn't taken until things start to go bad.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's typically through behaviors, or they've got themselves in trouble at work, or something's happens at home. Yeah. And so I know our supervisors do a really good job of really trying to talk to people and get a sense of something's not right there, and try to step in and those type of things. So it's constant. Like it's, you have to pay constant attention to people and ensure that the resources are there. And stigma has gone, like I said before, the stigma has gone down, but it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Like there would obviously be some officers who may be seeking counseling or support, and they would not tell a soul,
mm-hmm.
which is fine, right? Yeah. Which is fine, mm-hmm. but it's you know, too bad that we have to be in that world. But
right.
you know, we'll build the programs anonymous just because of that. So
totally,
yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you do now recently have hired on some social workers that are a part of the service as well. Correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you find that's been, you know, a very positive, I guess, additions to the service?
Yeah, I mean, they're the nice thing, and we're looking for, you know, we talked about funding. We're looking for further funding for, you talk about some of these mental health calls, and I, you know, I don't want to, you know, talk about the severity of some, but some are less dangerous than others. So,
for sure. Totally.
So is there, we're trying to figure out where's policing reside in some of this. And we, mm-hmm. you know, I always, you know, chuckle, I say people will call us, after 5 o'clock and on weekends, because we're typically the group that's working. Mm-hmm. So we go to a number of calls. Like we go to a lot of things you sometimes think an officer wouldn't go to. It's because we're a service, but we need to, someone needs to go there and provide some help. But mm-hmm. is there someone else that's better trained to go? Is there someone else that has more experience?
Totally.
Could officers be directed towards proactive policing, or, you know, follow-up investigations, or assisting, you know, getting into the schools and talking to kids? You know, could we be doing different things that we could have some experts in to have that understanding of, you know, there's so much training for an officer, whether it be physical training, firearms training, and we inundate them with online training and but you can only be an expert at so many things. So.
Yes, totally. And my thought process was, I was actually going to ask about the whole, because last year we dealt with, and you saw it online, the defund the police and bringing in social workers. And my thought process is like, wouldn't that would just be an addition? Don't defund what you currently have. Mm-hmm. Just add that to the arsenal, you know, because if you can have a well-equipped police service was now social work, but now the social workers can help the police officers understand the situations. So when they go to calls and there might be a mental health crisis, they're better equipped to have these conversations, right?
Yeah.
So it's constant, like it's not even like you're training, it's just on the job, constantly getting feedback from these social workers, right?
Yeah. When you look at if you look into the U.S., you'll see that those agencies that defunded, whether it be L.A. or in Minnesota, they're reversing. They're starting to fund police back again because they realize that you start to take away the services, you jeopardize the safety of your community.
Yeah.
And so they are
creation of anarchy.
Yeah. Right, so right, they right. are turning that around again. So it's interesting to see. It's I thought it was a horrible social experiment, but mm-hmm. again, we have a very supportive city council. I'm my bosses are the police commission, so mm-hmm. very supportive in regards to that, and mm-hmm. we try to be as efficient as we can with mm-hmm. our people and make sure that we're putting our people in the areas that are most needed, and so I'm glad that there's not a huge cry for defund the police here. I think that people just want to make sure that we're doing our best with what we have, and we're not overspending and things that aren't needed. So that's mm-hmm. that falls on me to make sure that's occurring.
Totally. Well, gentlemen, this has been a fantastic conversation. Unless nobody has anything else to say.
I could go for 3 days.
Yeah, I agree. Mike, thanks for doing this, man.
Absolutely.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for the service that you bring to the community. And thank you for doing this podcast. Thanks
being part of the solution.
Yeah.
Thanks for doing what you guys do.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Not going to miss the maple bugs.
Yeah, this place is infested. It's nuts.
So bad. As soon as we open that back door, it's just like...
Well, that's when I grew up. Yeah. There were maple bugs all over. And I moved up in Calgary, and then I never saw a maple bug again. And as soon as I come back, I was like, oh maple
yeah.
bugs.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So much for doing this, Mike. Shane, closing thoughts?
Again, thanks for doing this. You know, you're a busy guy, and I appreciate you taking the time. We're pretty small potatoes compared to probably what you're used to, so... You know, you hopping on with us is awesome. So we appreciate that.
Yeah, it's awesome. I appreciate the invite. This was great for me too.
Awesome. Rod?
Thanks for coming out. I mean, thanks for having that connection that we did when I got my hand slapped. Just because last year in school with the Truth and Reconciliation Week, Stephanie Harp or Marie Sinclair was talking about reconciliation in the communities and stuff like that. And I think your Zoom name is actually Chief Mike Warden.
Yeah.
So I was like, what if this is a police chief? So I shot him a private message, and it was before I started doing the stuff with Inner Man. And I asked about getting onto victim services with the police force, because I thought, I think at that same time, it was just when they were talking about defunding the police too and everything. So my thought process would be like, well, in an ideal world, it'd be great to have social workers on the force with them. So like you said, cops don't need to show up badge and gun with a mental health crisis,
right?
Where they can send in a social worker and calm everything down. Cause usually if you're getting called out, someone's already at like a 8 on their I'm spazzing out scale. And then showing up with cops with guns and badges, they could push them from an 8 to a 10. And now you're just increasing that trauma, or not trauma,
risk but level.
Risk level, yeah. But you can bring in a social worker and you can calm everything down. And my whole thought process is like, well, that's smart. Like, you don't need to defund the police. Just
add more to the arsenal.
Add it into the arsenal. Yeah. You don't even need to or rearrange your funds.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah, so that's why I got in trouble for that.
So you weren't in police trouble.
No.
Some people think that you got yourself in. It was
trouble with the college.
That's funny. That's funny. Mike, thanks again, man. Boys, let's have ourselves a good night. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.